This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island. From the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you.
Good evening. This is Rock Cash, your host this week on The People Speak. The People Speak invites audience participation. You can listen in by phone calling 716-748-0144. Or if you have a smartphone or a computer, go to bbsradio.com. Navigate to Station 2. Click on the listen icon. You can also participate during the show with calling questions for our guests. Toll free, USA and Canada, 888-429-5471. Joining us tonight, Pamela Means. Pamela is a partner in the Thompson Colburn LLP, the largest law firm in the St. Louis area. She's the first African American in the firm's history to be elevated to a partner from an associate since joining the firm in 1996. And she is also the president of the National Bar Association. Pamela, welcome.
Well, thank you so much for having me. What a pleasure.
Pamela, you're here to talk about changing the laws of that are protecting police officers. Is that correct?
I am here to talk about the laws that are needed to that need to change in order to protect both the community and officers.
Right. It seems ever more so that police officers are overriding the boundaries and the limitations that are guaranteed to us in the Bill of Rights.
Well, you know, some would say that, but, you know, once laws are passed and the Supreme Court declares them to be constitutional and they balance them out between our rights, then they have deemed that the rights that they give them are part of the Constitution. And we declare that the standard that the Supreme Court established in 1982, the standard is just so arbitrary and capricious that we were not at all surprised with the outcome, either in the Eric Garner case or in the Michael Brown case, because it is so consistent with the statistics that we see across the nation when it comes to officers involved shootings.
Right, but I don't see this as a racial thing. I see it more so as police authority taking a rise in a militarized form instead of being there to defend and protect the civilians.
Oh, I completely agree with you. I don't think that this is at all a race issue. I think the color issue it is a color blue. And I think that when race is infused in it, the reason we have the conversation and it centers so much on race is because you see that the large number of unarmed individuals that are killed are African American. So when you infuse race into the conversation, it just makes it more complex. But I couldn't agree with you more that this has more to do with the color blue and the authority that is granted to the color blue as opposed to the community that actually hires them to protect and serve them. So you and I are on the same page.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I've seen some actual beatings. I've seen, you know, I live in California and we're notorious with that. Here, over excessive force. I've been a victim of over excessive force by police officers in my younger days, even in compliance. You know,
yeah.
But that's not saying that all bad cops or all cops are bad. It's just saying that people are over using their power that is granted to them by the people.
I completely agree with you. You know, the National Bar Association did not wage a war against police officers. We waged a war against bad police officers, similar to the war we waged against bad teachers, bad doctors, and even bad lawyers. We don't want that which is not healthy to overtake that which is healthy. And so when you're dealing with police officers, the stakes are really too high when it comes to brutality issues, because we're talking about a matter of life and death. And so that's why it becomes an act of urgency.
Right. Now, as the Michael Brown case, I was topsy-turvy there for a little bit because, you know, I seen the initial reports. But somebody posted a video on my Facebook today that showed Michael Brown being a thug and beating on an elderly black man, knocking the guy out, and taking what he had and things of that nature. Is that the case to where Michael Brown was actually a thuggish kid?
Oh, I don't know about that. Let me tell you something. There were days when kids were kids and they did things that kid did. I've never known in America, though, for anyone to commit a crime or rob somebody and get sentenced to death. In our society, you can answer for your crime, you can pay for your crime, be rehabilitated, and allowed to go back in society. I think that in the situation with the Michael Brown and the Derrick Wilson situation, you got to look at the situations equal. I mean, here you have a young man who is his at the time he confronted Derrick Wilson, the greatest thing against him is he was large, he was big, and you look at Derrick Wilson. We know that he had at least two weapons on him. We know that he had a gun, and he had a car. He could have gotten in his car and driven away. And so I think when people attempt to look at a situation and say that a person deserved what they got, I take them to the situation of the young man, white guy who was in the Walmart store, and he was still in the cash register, and he confronted it and got into it with a police officer, tackled the police officer, grabbed for the police officer gun three times, and he lived to tell about it. And if that's not a thug, no, and nobody characterized him as a thug either. They didn't do any of that. So there is, there cannot be a justification based on what we perceive someone has done or what they could do as a rationale for why their lives deserve to be taken. Not when you have cases of individuals who walk into theaters and they shoot 14 people, but the cops don't take them out with a gun. They de-escalate the situation so that they can ensure that the person has their proper day in court. That's what we're really, really looking for in black and brown communities, that those kind of officers go and police those communities as well.
Well, yeah, I would take it that the police officers need to have a little bit more common courtesy when they're dealing with people, regardless of race, color, creed. That should have no bearing on who they're dealing with, but you know as well as I do, a majority of the population worldwide is a closet racist. I don't care what anybody says in any way, shape, or form, but people are racist, and we know that. If they a lot of times like to deal with their own people and things of that nature, but that factor should not play in a police officer's job whatsoever. The closet racist or any of that, that should not play in a police officer's job or his emotions or in his reasoning for doing what he does.
Oh, I completely agree with you. But the problem is that as I talk to police officers, they're not trained to protect people's civil rights. They are trained to police. And so they bring to the table with them their own systemic beliefs and systematic racism that's there. And remember, I see as much overuse of force sometimes with white cops as I do black cops. I hear black cops say some of the most horrific things that I've heard said by individuals because they bring their own sense of perceptions of a community there with them. But I completely agree with you that those, when you are paid, it's almost like, you know, police officers are hired by the community to protect and preserve them, which means that the police officer works for the community. Their boss is the community. In what job could you go in and you be overly aggressive with your boss and utilize unfair treatment against them, and they leave you in the position you're in. So I completely agree with you, but we have to deal with the issues of what gets a person to that point. And until we train and condition them not to be that way, we cannot ignore and pretend like it's not there.
Well, I can tell you why, because the citizenry is too passive and they're allowing it to happen. Like, for instance, I, you know, got tickets for not licensing my dogs. But at the same time, I've been complaining about the retailer that is behind us making noise through all hours of the night, and they're not doing nothing about it. So in that case, if you're not willing to enforce the laws on a corporation, how dare you come to me, one of the people that employs you, and tell me that you're going to enforce the codes that you're on me that you're not willing to enforce on the corporation.
And you know what that's called? And you've really hit on it. And in the law, it's called having a law in the book that doesn't equally apply to individuals and equally apply to the people that are in that community means that there's a law, but the application of the law is applied differently. And that's really what the community does need to stand up and say it's not acceptable at all.
Exactly. But once again, it's the fault of the citizenry for allowing it to happen like that.
And you know what? I think the citizenry now is coming to a point where they're saying, no, no more. And I think that's the reason why there is individuals are not quieting down, even when the government is saying, we're going to fix this situation. I think there is a disbelief that this will change unless people continue to make noise. I really do believe that in the situation of that police brutality right now would not be getting the attention that it got had not individuals just persisted to make noise, you know, in the Ferguson area and say it's not acceptable. At some point, this has to become unacceptable. And, you know, Martin Luther King said it best, protest is the voice of the unheard. And as people began to hear them, they started to really look at numbers and look at statistics and even look at the fact that, you know, here you have Ferguson, whose number one driver in their economy was what? It was petty crimes. Tickets.
Correct. Correct. Well, what a lot of people don't know is that jails are businesses. They're really not correctional facilities. They're just a business to make money. And whether it's coming from the taxpayers or anybody else, I believe that they're overdoing it with that role as far as minor things like marijuana, putting people in jail for drugs and stuff like that. I can't arrest people for being stupid. That's my own.
Right.
That's my own theory on that. But I do see it as an ever-growing business, and I do see it as an ever-growing extortion racket for the people that are not common criminals, or they're there for certain reasons, and the threat of jail is held upon them because of maybe a street fine or a traffic violation. You know, it's absurd because I've been in courtrooms here in California where I've watched cases go on, and it's a joke. It's an absolute complete joke, and it's an extortion racket. And I think we need to change our legal system and make it coherent to the people.
Well, and when you say change the legal system, are you talking about how cases are tried, or tell me what you're talking about?
Yeah, well, pretty much how cases are tried and how they're just using it as a business more than anything else, because it seems like when honest, hardworking people are going in there, they just want to extort dollars out of them. And the thugs or the guys that are doing things on a repetitive basis that they know they're not going to get anything out of, they're, you know, just giving them a slap on the wrist and sending them on their way.
And you know, that's in some people's cases. It doesn't happen that way in all cases. I was just on the show before yours, and someone asked me, is it possible for two individuals of different races to commit the same crime and a harsher punishment to go to another individual? And I said, absolutely. It all depends on the discretion of the judge. Judge normally has, you know, the discretion, you know, to be able to sometimes arrange. Sometimes there's a mandatory sentence, and sometimes there's a range of what acts that can be given, and people exercise that judgment based on whether they feel like people are worthy, you know, of what they call the break, or deserving of being able to be taught a lesson.
Right. I've got some questions from the audience. They're popping up on my screen.
Absolutely.
Okay, Alexander from Scotland wants to know what you think of the men who killed, Darren Wilson and these people.
You know what? I don't think ill of Darren Wilson, and I don't think ill of the officer that was the officer from New York. I really think their training system failed them. I think they weren't ready. If you look at the officer in Cleveland, he had problems on his previous post that he was on, where the officer said that he was not responsible, and that, you know, that you know, that he froze on occasion. Those are signs that perhaps he needed to not be sent out again without some more proper training. I think the training fails them, and I think the system is set up where we don't do enough due diligence in terms of heavy psychological training, of testing, diversity training, and training to understand that the police work for the community, not the other way around, and that people have to get to know the individuals that they work with so that the environment is cohesive. I think on one level the system failed them, but on another level I think it's sad when someone is in a position of that nature where they take a life and the remorse is not there. It appeared in the case of the New York. I do understand the mother's response, you know, of her unwillingness at that moment, the wife's response of her unwillingness, Ms. Garner's unwillingness to accept the apology. But that's the first time I've seen an officer actually extend his apologies for a situation. There's always this brazen kind of thing of, we had to do what was absolutely necessary in order to protect our lives. But I'm going to tell you that I really do think the narrative would have been different, and it would have been very similar to the Mike Brown situation had there been no videotape as it related to the Eric Garner situation. That there definitely would have been, you know, a situation where they would have said he was a big guy who was trying to overpower them, and they had to take them down. Two, I think the legal system sets up a standard that doesn't really teach officers how to de-escalate forces appropriately in environments, as opposed to escalation of a force. When your legal system says that you may elevate force to the level that you believe is necessary in order to protect your life, and it gives you code words to say inside of that and make it okay to do, it only sets up an environment where people, instead of them being in a community where they protect it and they de-escalate force, they feel a need to immediately see threat and to elevate that force. So on some levels, I think their training system actually failed them.
Yeah, I agree. John in Louisiana wants to know, what exactly is the National Bar Association doing regarding the Michael Brown case and Darren Wilson case?
Let me tell you what we're doing. We launched, as a result of Eric Garner's death back in July, before there was a Mike Brown situation, we launched a national war against police brutality. And in that, we selected 25 cities that had a large population of African Americans with a high number of complaints against police brutality. And I put together some experts, both who are prosecutors and defense attorneys, and said, how can we solve this problem and what can we do as lawyers? And they said, one of the best things to do is for the federal government to come in and open up these practice and procedures examinations. So we did an open records request to these 25 locations and asked them to give us the documentation so we could put a report together for Attorney General Holder and say, here are some egregious cases that are going on, and here are some departments that you probably need to seize and take over. But I said to them, while we're gathering that information, what else can we do? So since July, we have been going around the country to those 25 locations, and we've been holding Know Your Rights because it can save your life forms inside of those communities. We pass out their constitutional right. We discuss with them about the epidemic of police brutality, how to interact when you are confronted with police officers, because the real key is to make it home and make it home alive so that you can fight another day. So we actually go out into the community, educate, and get our lawyers motivated in that area to become agents of change. In addition, we have been promoting four pieces of legislation. One is look, stop sending military equipment to these locations. Dismantle that, sell it, break it down and sell it, send money to these locations to get body cams. So we're happy that the president heard us and that he's doing this, but we recognize body cams are not enough. And what we say in the law is that we have written is that make it an offense for an officer to tamper with the body camera. In addition, add some definition to elevation of force and add some definition to excessive force, and then train officers on how to de-escalate in a situation as opposed to escalation. And the last piece of legislation we say is make it a felony for an officer to be standing next to another officer, see him engage or her engage in excessive force, and not stop it. If you and I go into a store together and I committed a murder and you didn't even know about it, and I committed a robbery, somebody died, I would go to jail and so would you, and it would be called felony murder. And we're saying put some accountability. In addition, we're asking local police officers, city councils to interact legislation that interacts stricter mental health testing and diversity training, not on a one-time basis, but on a continual quarterly basis. Interact more community relations between the police officers and the force. And we're saying revamp the grand jury system. Bring in an independent investigator on a state level and an independent prosecutor. Because if these two cases haven't taught us anything else, they have taught us that the grand jury system is damaged. In the case of Darren Wilson, we have also asked for the Missouri Department of Public Safety to revoke Mr. Wilson's license permanently. And we did that because we understand that the system is broken right now. And until the laws change, and until states enact laws that protect citizens, and until cities and police departments take ownership and train their individuals in the right way, the only recourse we have is that when we see an officer that uses something that is egregious, that we say, until you fix your system, we cannot afford to have that person carry a gun around and protect a community that he is quite frankly afraid to protect. So that's what we're doing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. He shouldn't be in there if he's fearful.
No.
You know, and there is no reason to be fearful if you have the respect of the community.
That's exactly correct. And when you build on, as you stated, I like your real talk of all of us are racist on some level, but it gets down to the core of having that conversation that we don't want to have, which is at the core of what we're dealing with in these two cases is some level of racism. But I agree with you. The gentleman that got killed in Indiana, who dad changed the law and made it a requirement that there be an independent investigator, he wasn't black, he was white. And the injustice that was issued out to Mr. Wilson, Michael Brown parents and Ms. Garner was the same injustice that was issued out to him. And he took the money that he got and he went and he lobbied for the change in laws because he recognized that until the system changes, we will have a repeat of what we see. And many people have asked us at the National Bar Association, why don't you file a lawsuit to redo the grand jury system in Missouri? And I say, you know, we're looking at that aspect, but I will say to you, why send back a set of facts to a system that's broken? The system is damaged. And if we don't fix the system, the continued pattern of sending it to the system is not going to yield justice. What will yield justice is the change in laws on the federal level, because the standard of proof that you need in order to find something excessive force and elevation of force is a federal standard because of the Supreme Court case from 1982. That has to be changed on the federal level. The other things I talked about can be changed at a state level and a local level.
Well, it's not just a state level, but it's a national level.
Yes.
It needs to be handled. I mean, we had the same problem here with a transient that everybody in the neighborhood loved, but he was killed by two police officers. And as you watched the entire video of Kelly Thomas, it's clear that these police officers were there to harass Mr. Kelly Thomas because he's a transient. And
exactly.
They ended up killing him. So, you know, and they got just a pat on the hand, and they were relieved of duty, I believe, or one of them is still on the job. But these guys should be tried for murder. They're not above the law. Nobody's above the law.
Well, they're not above the law, but because of, here's the problem, but when the national standard is that an officer may elevate force to the level that he believes or she believes is reasonable in order to protect their lives, if they believe that their lives is in danger, that standard, we call that in the law arbitrary and capricious. And when you have a standard of that nature that is so loose, what you're really asking a jury to do is to put themselves in the place of an officer. And that is just difficult and hard to do. You know, I completely agree with you that if you look, the National Bar Association has been saying since July, this is a national epidemic. And until we recognize that you can find a Eric Garner, a Mike Brown, you can find these individuals in New York, in California, in North Carolina. I can give you a slew of names of individuals of places that we went to where parents have wished that their kids had the national attention and they could get justice like these individuals are getting. That's kind of sad that a parent would want that attention, but it's not sad that when your child dies and you feel like their life means nothing, that you would not want that kind of attention. But I have met so many parents across this country who have said, my kid was killed 3 years ago, 5 years ago. And in each case, what they said was is that the prosecuting attorney found that it was justifiable homicide. Someone asked me the question today, does it matter that the coroner issued said that Garner's death was a homicide, or that the coroner in the Mike Brown case said it was a homicide? I said no, because the standard under the law is whether or not it was a justifiable homicide. And based on the standard that we have as it relates to police killings, it is justifiable if they believe their life is in danger and they use the force that they believe was necessary to stop that danger.
Wow. Well, with that, go to break real quick, and we'll be right back here on the BBS Radio Network with our guest, Pamela Means.
Got questions? The library's got answers, and books and magazines and CDs and videos and web access and databases and all sorts of other resources at your library. In a world that's information rich, libraries are information smart. Find the right answer and a whole lot more at your library.
With over 150 million registered users, PalTalk is the largest video chat community in the world, with over 300 PalTalk support staff speaking dozens of languages to help you enjoy your online experience. Meet new people across town or country or continent while chatting about your interests. Sing live karaoke, listen to music, join a lively political debate, or play group trivia in one of thousands of chat rooms in various categories from your PC, mobile, or tablet device. Joining PalTalk is free and easy. Go to paltalk.com and become part of our friendly community today.
In America, most of us have the basics we need to survive, but there are millions of children all over the world who don't. Children who must work instead of going to school. children who were forced to fight as child soldiers, children who can't have an ordinary childhood because they lack health care, clean water, or good nutrition. For these children, there is UNICEF. UNICEF works in 157 countries and territories, providing children with what they need to survive and grow. To learn more, visit unicefusa.org or call 1-800-4-UNICEF.
Hello, this is Wesley Snipes. And when I'm divinely inspired and spiritually motivated, I listen to VBSRadio.com.
In a world of abundance, hunger is a crime. When a malnourished child dies, we're all guilty. Yet it happens every 5 seconds. Let's do the right thing. Put hunger away for good. Please, give to the World Food Program.
This land is your land.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests of various organizations share their work and strategies which impact our world and make a difference. That's The People Speak every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you and me.
All right, this is Rod Cash. Welcome back to the BBS Radio Network and the People Speak with us, Pamela J. Means of the National Bar Association. Pamela, we left off on the finish note of what they are doing to us and what the grand juries are. I have more questions from people. Ellen in Oregon wants to know, what about the guy from New York that was in a chokehold? I believe she's talking about Gardner. Now, what was the reason for them stopping Mr. Gardner? Was it because he was selling loose cigarettes?
Well, they thought that he was selling loose cigarettes. It was never proven, nor was there anything in the report that he actually was doing it. Recall that they had stopped this and arrested this guy about 30 times for the same petty crime. So they were familiar now with this gentleman, and they thought this time on the streets that he may have been doing it again.
A secondary question: why would selling loose cigarettes be against the law?
Well, because it's ordinances are passed by city councils, and they establish what is considered to be a crime and not a crime. And so the city ordinance in Staten Island made it a crime to sell loose cigarettes without a license. So that's the crime that was placed on the books. Crimes are established by statute that are passed by your legislators, whether they're state or federal. Mm-hmm.
Is it because they feel that they're losing revenue of the taxes that Mr. Gardner, or the revenue that Mr. Gardner might be making?
Oh, absolutely. You could probably think part of the rationale, too, is that you probably had some stores that were in the area that sell cigarettes that say, here we are, we sell them, and we're losing money because they're taking our product and they're reselling them, and that ought to be against the law. It's economics. We all know that some of the things that happen when it boils down to it, it can always be traced back to a color that many of us don't talk about a lot, which is the color green. So, well, I mean, it's just like in the Ferguson case, as I stated, their number two revenue generator was petty crimes.
Okay. Having a background of living in New York and working in the delis and the stores and everything else, I know that it was against the law for store owners to sell loose cigarettes also. Now, with that being said, how is it going to affect the store owners? They're still selling the cigarettes to Mr. Gardner, but the thing is, he's taking the burden off of them. So I can't see where they would be complaining, because in New York, a majority of the people, especially the people that are homeless, out in the streets, everything else, they scrounge up change from here and there just so that they can get a cigarette.
Yeah, but you would think that if it's unlawful for them to sell cigarettes, could you imagine if now they get crimes put on them for selling cigarettes? Surely they wouldn't want somebody else to take their product and do what they cannot do legally, even within their stores. So there could exactly. be a whole number of rationale for why it is the city council felt that it was right, you know, for loose cigarettes not to be sold. You can even go up to, it could be connected, you know, if you trace the law and look at the comments that were made, you may even find that, were there any companies that sell cigarettes? Did they make any comments as it related to it? You just never know. But what we do know is that it was a crime for anyone to sell loose cigarettes. And so that's the reason why. But it was a petty crime. It was not. It was a misdemeanor.
Right.
It was.
And
it wasn't a felony.
And that was no case for Mr. Gardner to end up dead because a police officer wanted to put him into a chokehold.
That's exactly correct. But not only that, it was a crime that was punishable with a fine. So it's not even a crime that ended that, you know, remember they had actually arrested him over 30 times. So it's not like it's a crime, you know, that they were arresting him where he sold cigarettes. And then the next time they arrested him with the broken windows theory where he was then robbing somebody. And then the next crime where it was being elevated. I mean, they were really going after him for the same thing. But if you listen even to his wife speak, she said, you know, there was some harassment of him. They would call him the cigarette man, and they called her the wife of the cigarette man. And so there was, they knew who he was in that particular situation. They were familiar with him.
Okay. And Violet in Florida wants to know if we can get some stats on the crime rate in Ferguson compared to the rest of the nation in and before all of this went down.
You know what? I don't have it compared to the rest of the nation, but I will tell you that if you look at the stat rates that were, and remember these statistics are all being offered, okay, by, they're being offered by the police department in terms of stops and pullovers. And not only are they offered by the police department, they are offered up to the Department of Public Safety. And the Department of Public Safety oftentimes rejects some of these statistics because they say they're not valid. But if we look at the, you know, 68% of the individuals in Ferguson are African American, which is completely kind of different from what the turn was, let's say 20 some years ago. But if you look at the statistics that are there, you'll see that there were a large number of African Americans that were pulled over for traffic stops. And of that large number, though, you had more whites who were found with contraband, that is drugs, on them than there were African Americans. And that's based on statistics that they reported to the Department of Public Safety.
Great. Let's focus back on the conversation we were having on break. Why are they going after people that are smoking marijuana and not going after the big drug corporations for selling dangerous drugs?
Well, if you look at it, there is a disparity in sentences, and there is a disparity in the charges that are related to crimes that are related to marijuana and cocaine. There is just a disparity because of the people making the laws and the lobbying groups that are there. And you look at they don't look at legalized. You know, there are some drugs that are considered to be legalized. And so they don't consider that to be a harm against society, you know, as opposed to individuals who are dealing with illegal drugs. But as you can see, New York did what recently? They made what? Marijuana what? Not a crime
legal.
Anymore. It's not, illegal.
Yep. It's not legal, but it's not a crime.
Right.
So
exactly.
it's an oxymoron, in other words.
Yes. it is. If you're using it for medicinal purposes, it's no longer
right.
What? Punishable.
A crime.
But it does have a conflict of how is it something that was considered to be, so dangerous that the punishment for it had greater sentences weight than cocaine did. How now is it not proven that it's not dangerous? So it does make one question and think, is there a disparity in how we treat individuals, you know, who we say engage in what we consider to be illegal narcotics, as opposed to individuals who most people would say corporations engage in what is considered to be legal narcotics?
Great, great. We've got a caller on the line from down under, Steve from Australia. Go ahead, Steve. Steve, are you with us?
Yeah, thank you very much, Rock. I do have a very quick question. If Pamela has ever heard of the Peelian principles of policing, these are the 9 principles that were the basis of the modern-day policing system that we have. Have you heard of these Peelian principles? And if you do learn about them, could you apply them to the U.S. police force? Go ahead.
You know what? I have not heard about them, and I would love to know about what they are so that we can see if we could apply them. Could you share that with me?
Yes, ma'am. There's a basis that the police officers should be members of the community and working for the benefits of the community, and they spell out the very roles that police should have in modern society. And I believe a lot of the police forces around the world have overlooked these very basis principles that they were formed on. They basically say they've got to be community officers for the benefit of all the community, and not just rogue thugs that are roaming around harassing people and arresting people willy-nilly.
These
principles have turned into the laws that we now have. So I would recommend that you do have a good look into the 9 Peelian principles, spelled P-E-E-L-I-A-N. The Peelian principles are very fascinating.
P-E-E-L-A-I-N?
L-I-A-N. That is correct.
L-I-A-N.
I'm going to look up that because I completely agree with you that until we move to a system where we go back to where the cops are part of the community, because there was a time when Bob was a cop and he saw Joe's son and he said, that's just Joe's son acting crazy, as opposed to that's Joe's son, that's a threat. I completely agree until they see themselves as an extension of the individuals that hired them to protect and preserve them. They're not really doing their job. I completely agree. And that's part of what we're really calling for, even in passing of ordinances, that there must be some community-based relation building things that are incorporated into the police interaction with the community. I'm going to look that up.
Thank you out to Steve from Australia. Pamela, we need to go back to grassroots.
Absolutely.
And we need to take back not only our local situation, but the entire situation. It's out of our hands. And we need to put it back into our hands. Otherwise, it's going to be a failed system.
You know, I don't disagree with you. I'll tell you what, whenever a nation feels that it cannot trust the individuals that say they represent them, cannot trust the people that they say serve them, and have lost faith and confidence that they must themselves protect themselves, we've gotten to a place where we say we need to reevaluate a lot of things. I think instead of us being so critical of individuals who want their voices to be heard, we should ask what got us to this point where young people of all races, you don't just see African Americans out there marching. You don't just see Hispanics out there marching. You don't just see women. You see men, boys, young, old, middle age, of all races and creed, of all religion background, saying that we have a problem. And until we take a core look at why they feel like this is not their America, this is not their communities, and instead that they're at odds with their community, and we have real long, hard conversations where we start to build that communal relationship back up again, you're right. People are going to continue to feel like this is no longer my community, this is no longer my America, and I need to take it back. I wish we were in a posture where we didn't feel like we had to take something back, because I wish it was at a place where we listened to and not spoke at, but spoke with individuals and each other. I had a gentleman call me tonight, and he was very angry with something that he read that the National Bar Association said, and he started yelling, you know, at me on the phone. And I said to him, sir, I will give you an opportunity to speak with me, but you will respect me. I will respect your right to disagree with me, and you're going to respect my right not to agree with you. But we're going to talk to each other to see if there's a way that we can find commonality so that at the end of the day, we can deal with what the issue is and not because I don't like how you said and how you said. And then he said at the end of the night to me, well, you know what? I have some black friends in Ohio that are reasonable, and maybe you may be reasonable. And I said, I'll take that. And the reason I thought that was important is because of what you said at the beginning of the show. America belongs to us as a unit, as a group. My black sisters, my brother, my black and white sisters, my Hispanic sisters and brothers, my white sisters and brothers, together as a unit, we change. My Asian brothers and sisters, we change and make America what it is. It belongs to we the people. We the people, and that's what the National Bar Association, we stand and say, we the people define what is just. Not a rogue government, not calling for people to burn things and do things of that nature, but we're saying the fundamental system is broken, and we the people are responsible for fixing it.
Oh, absolutely. And with that being said, I've got another caller, Robert Kinsel, on line two. Go ahead, Robert.
Anyway, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead, Robert.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead, Robert.
I'm on speaker, Rock. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Good. Okay. Anyway, my question was slightly, well, not really off topic, but includes the political situation that's gone on here. And what disappoints me, Rock, and I wanted to see if Pamela can comment on this. I think we've pushed back race relations in this country 30 or 40 years with the animosity felt about this, because I think this whole thing has been about the wrong person. You see, to a lot of people, Michael Brown is a thug. He's certainly not a victim and certainly not worthy of this kind of attention. And I also don't consider the gentleman in New York as too much of a victim either. But when you've got somebody like the kid in Cleveland with the cops pulling up too close to him, firing immediately, things like that, that itself, to me, is far more worthy of scrutiny than the scrutiny brought about here, where, to me, it's asinine for these people to go out and march for Michael Brown, basically a thug. And, you know, the same thing with this Ghana guy, not a thug, but not really a pillar of the community. Now, should this have happened to him? No, he shouldn't. But guess what? He did have the option to surrender to police, and it wasn't his debut at this kind of attention from police. And he decided to play some sort of dance with the police. And, of course, it doesn't matter what color people are. If I'm a white guy and the police are telling me I'm under arrest, which I am a white guy, by the way, and I decide to jerk them around, guess what? I'm going to have my face planted in the pavement with my arms behind my back in handcuffs. End of story. That's what's going to happen. And I think people need to realize they've got to address this. This is what the police are going to do. If you jerk the police around, or if you try and attack the police by rushing them in their car and try and trap them between the B pillar of the car and the door of the car, guess what? They're not playing, and they don't care what color you are. And I think this is a big issue. I think it's pushed things back, and I'd like Pamela to see what she thinks about that.
I think he brought up an excellent, excellent point, and I think this is where the conversation should somewhat be, because in America, you don't get sentenced to death for being a thug, ever. In America, it's our America, and we have a justice system and a judicial system that says that if you commit a crime, that you go through our system, you are innocent until proven guilty, and then you go through the system and you the system tries you, and then you get your day in court, you get to pay your debt to society, and you live. I would agree with him if we didn't have so many cases like Sedan Sareed from South Carolina, who walked into a Walmart and he tried to steal a cash register several times, terrorized all of the customers in the store, led the police on a foot chase, made attempts three times to grab the officer's weapon, and they arrested him. I agree with him that if you resist the cops, if in fact you struggle with them, that you are going to end up in handcuffs. And I don't disagree that a cop should arrest you if you resist arrest. I don't think a cop should put his life in jeopardy and not be able to do what's necessary to apprehend a suspect. But when the inkling is to always elevate force and not de-escalate a situation in a community of color, that tells you we have a problem. I disagree with him that we've pushed race relations back 30 years. I think what we've done is exposed how we have never dealt with race relations in this country. That is a very difficult conversation to have. It's a difficult conversation for people of my race to say there are certain things we can do to educate ourselves and do things better from within. But that's not the answer, and you can't stop there. Because it's not acceptable in any situation for an officer to assume that as soon as he sees a person of color, that person of color is considered to be guilty until proven innocent, as opposed to the other way around. And as long as we skate around this issue, we're going to come back to this. Look, we were dealing with this issue in the 60s when the Panthers were created in Oakland, California. They formed because of police brutality. Rappers rapped about it in the 80s and 90s, but we preferred not to listen to them because it was easier to shoot the messenger than listen to the message. The only reason America is paying attention to it now is because a thing called video cameras, and people are starting to see their abuse, and they can't deny it with their eyes. But when we get to a day where we say it's okay to kill and take out a thug, then you got to tell me why it is Sedan Sareed is still alive. You have to tell me why it is the guy that went into a theater and shot up individuals because of a Batman movie, why is he still alive? Or the gentleman that walked into a congresswoman crowd and shot up a little girl in a crowd, why is he still alive? Why is a woman that walked because she didn't get tenured and she goes into her goes into the professor's lounge and she starts shooting up people, but she's alive? When you have a series of de-escalation happen, I say give me those officers in black communities. Let those officers teach other officers how to de-escalate force as opposed to escalate force. Then he and I will be on the same page always, because I don't believe that you should be able to commit a crime and get away with it. I don't believe that you should be able to resist arrest and not think you're not going to go to jail. But I don't think doing any of those things is a death sentence at the hands of a police officer.
I agree with you on that point, but I want to disagree with both of you. I think that race relations are strengthening because the people that I see out there marching are of all different colors, creeds, and races.
I agree with you on that. No, I do agree with you on that. I agree that it has unified us some. But, you know, you have to admit that we don't like having this difficult conversation. It's uncomfortable. It is hard. It is hard for me to say to you, it is hard for me to sit on a phone with a guy who threatens to kill me, but have the conversation with him. And you know why I have the conversation with him? Because I want him to get to know me as a person.
Oh, absolutely.
And not by the quality of my skin. I want him to understand that I have a 13-year-old son who's a straight-A student at a mixed school, and he's as dark as the day. And what I want to prevent is any officer ever looking at my son and thinking he looks like a devil or he's that child that he has to fear. I want to change the narrative and to say my son is your son.
Oh, absolutely.
And my son is a part of your community, and that you will protect him as hard and stand up for his rights as much as I will yours. When we get to that point, then I will say we're at a point where we should be in the conversation. But I feel right now, as a lawyer with 3 degrees, a master's, a bachelor's degree, a law degree, I fear for my 13-year-old son that someone may see him and he may look to a different way at them and they may assume that he is a target, that he's a thug, that he's a criminal because he acted a certain way or he was big or he's lazy. That's what scares me the most.
I agree with you. One last question before we...
The likelihood that it happens when you look at the statistics, that's the danger. And that's the reason why, with the National Bar Association, we're doing the things we're doing.
Good, good. Last question from Don in Northern California. He wants to know, do you feel that parents, law enforcement nationwide needs to help the citizens understand how to properly interact with the law if stopped and arrested or being questioned to ensure both remain safe?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's our job. I think that's part of the reason why the National Bar Association does go around the country and say, look, brother, sister, this is not the time to prove to anybody that you're bad. This is the time for you to understand that when a police comes to your car and pulls you over, they are trained to come to your car with their hands on their gun. Sit still. Don't move. Don't reach for your license or anything else. Talk them through what it is you're doing. Ask for permission. It's absolutely our job. It is our obligation to do it.
Great, great. We got to have you back on again. A wonderful interview. Thank you for joining us, Pamela.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. Can I thank you for always keeping it real? Can I thank you for always being true to your convictions and having the difficult conversations? It's only with people like you that we will make this a movement and not just a conversation. So on behalf of the National Bar Association, I appreciate the work you're doing.
Thank you. And people, make sure to join us next week. We'll have Kate Horvath, and she'll speak about her book, The Ten Hail Marys That Helped Change Laws in Australia. Make sure you join us right here on The People Speak. This is Rock Cash signing off, and with a wonderful thanks to our sound engineer, Don Newsom. And thank you again, Pamela. Have a good evening.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the steeple by the relief office, I saw my people and they stood there hungry and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.